This is The Conversation. It's episode 115 with artist Zach Smith. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images going along with this episode. Some intriguing images, I would say. If you are not familiar with Zach Smith's work, as I wasn't before we started communicating, you can get a sample of it there. You can also find links to social media. You can donate to the show and so on. And speaking of donating, I want to thank a woman artist who I will leave anonymous. My sense is she would prefer to remain anonymous. But she did share with me that she was listening to the podcast as she prepared for her exhibition, which just opened and sold very well, I'm happy to report. And she gave a very nice donation to the podcast. So thank you very much to her. If you would like to donate, it would always be much appreciated. I put a little intro about donating because it's a listener-supported show before the prior episode with Roger Dwight, and I have received 3 donations. So thank you to all of you who have donated, and hopefully more of you will join. Before we get to Zach's conversation, I wanted to just mention a brief observation that I was listening to Fresh Air, the extremely long-lived NPR interview show with Terry Gross, and she has had very, very few visual artists on the show, as you may know, over the years. She had one last week, Andy Goldsworthy, the Scottish sort of earth-land improvisation with nature artist. And I did listen to a little bit of it, but then I got bored with it, which goes to prove one of my theories, which is when you make conversations about a visual medium, particularly visually oriented dialogue for an audio medium, does not hold your interest very long. And, you know, it may have been some other issues, but I that was my experience with it. I'd love to know what you thought of it if you heard it. One more thing before we get to the Zach conversation, I just want to let you know that we recorded it in his loft slash apartment in downtown LA. And within his apartment, he's got all kinds of knickknacks and ephemera of interest. He also has a giant fishbowl. So the acoustics that you are hearing are because we recorded inside that fishbowl. The fishbowl is equipped with all your typical knickknacks, including rocks, you know, a little, you know, a Roman arch sort of cave type thing, and of course a diver. And we took the diver helmet and we put it on Aaron's head. And that's why Aaron Morse, my co-host, sounded the way he does. So just wanted to give you a heads up about that. Let's get to that conversation now. Thank you very much for being here, and I'll talk to you more on the back end. That for now. This is The Conversation, and I am joined by longtime, it's been a while, a veteran, though, of the podcast, Aaron Morse.
Hello.
And we are joined by Zach Smith.
Hey.
Hey. All right, well, as I warned you, so here's the line from your most recent piece called Yale Pit Crit that I had to ask you about.
Okay.
It's the one where you say, why in an age where you can't even swing a dead shark without hitting a podcast about politics, philosophy, comedy, or knitting, there's no serious podcast about art? It's a little out of context, but in any case, you could still answer.
I don't mean to say that none of the podcasts that exist about art are good. I'm saying that if you walked up to a random person, even in the art world, and went, what's the podcast of record for the art world? They wouldn't know. You know what I mean? Like, we haven't reached a consensus about what the media center of art is. And that's definitely not true for a lot of other NPR worthy subjects. Like, there's a lot of communities that have coalesced around the media, and around old print media. Like, art form is the center. Art form is a thing. We can point to art form and we know what we're talking about. It's been, you know, the internet's been, you know, we're 20 years in to internet media. We should have a podcast by now that is like, you know, there should be like, we shouldn't have we shouldn't be thinking about art form as the center of media in the internet age, but we still do. Like the art world hasn't moved to new media yet in terms of like dispersing itself. It doesn't have a TV show. It doesn't have a YouTube. It doesn't have a, you know, so while I think probably if you're doing an art podcast, you're probably a pretty hardworking person. And you're probably dedicated to the form. It is odd that how far behind in terms of new media the art world is when within the art, they're obsessed with new media, you know? And that's a thing.
That's
right?
Yeah. That's a, I'm glad you clarified in that way, because the default in a lot of cases, especially in the earlier days of this podcast anyway, was, you know, when the numbers maybe weren't where I always want them to be, was to say, oh, well, you know, ironically, a lot of our art people are not that technology savvy.
I also think like artists, at least ones who paint, or sculpt, listen to podcasts more than anyone else in the world because they are sitting at a table.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised a little bit that it hasn't like, that there isn't yet a consensus around. Of course, if there was a consensus around a certain podcast, we'd all hate it and be like, oh, that fucking podcast. But, you know, it is weird that like comedy has a podcast. It's like Marc Maron is like a guy of record for that, you know, and the art, despite being really interested in media in a way, hasn't really become a thing yet, but it will. So you're on the ground floor. Congratulations.
Aaron and I suspected that we were talking about it beforehand. He suggested maybe it was bad at sports that you were talking about because they've actually been around the longest of the art podcasts.
I mean, here's the thing. There's absolutely not a single art podcast that I've heard recommended to me twice. Like, no two separate people have both said, oh, this one from – so I've heard of that podcast and I've listened to, like, one episode of different podcasts, but it's – but you're not at a point where people are all having a conversation about the same thing, and that is what creates debate, and that's what creates community, is even if the thing isn't that good, it's like why everyone gets on Twitter and talks about the GOP debate, and it's stupid. But it's like we all have a center. We have something to talk about, and that's why, like – you know, when a TV show was on at one time, like MASH was on at 7, everyone would watch MASH at that moment because it was a center, you know, and that's why Art Forum still has a position, is not because of the magazine in a sense, but almost because it's a center. You can say, like, who was on the cover, what was going on, and the museums act the same way. They're like, we can all talk about the Broad Museum this month. Like, we all get to do that. And nobody's necessarily very informed, or there isn't that much to talk about, or, like, some people have gone and some people hasn't. But it gives everybody in art something to talk about right now. And I think that until there's a podcast that is that, like, a center, you know, like, then that at that point is when we all acknowledge that.
Well, you know, what you're making me think now is that all these artists are listening to the podcast, but nobody else is. And the other people are the ones who are making that more public. The artists are only talking about amongst themselves.
Maybe, but I mean, I talk a lot of artists, and they're mostly just talking about...
they're talking about comedy podcasts.
Or cops getting shot, or cops shooting people. You know, like, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about... I do want to actually... So that quote that I started with comes from your piece, Yale Pitgrift, and I think it'd be interesting to talk about that. So I'm going to guess that you probably were not one of the people who cried in the pit.
You're the one who talked back.
It was not – yeah, I was definitely a talk backer and not a crier. But
you were contrarian even then.
I was never contrarian. And I know that sounds very contrarian. But like, like to me, a contrarian is like, whatever's going on, I'm going to do the opposite. And I was like, that – like I am taking up on a loan for God knows how many years of my life just to go here. Like I'm not – gonna go and then say everything here is stupid. That's like I felt like there's a different, like I had a thing I wanted to do that was very specific, and some things lined up with that and some things didn't. The things that didn't I didn't like, and the things that did I did like. And I contrarian just doesn't like anything, and that's just like an attitude, it's not a philosophy.
You were a resistor even then.
Yeah, but it was because I was insisting on something else. It wasn't just to resist, you know. For a little context for the people, I wrote this column for Artillery magazine called Decoder, which is, I take things that are sort of normal rituals of the art world for artists and write about them for the benefit of people who haven't been through them or don't know much about them. So I wrote a piece called Yale Pit Crit about how critiques worked at Yale, specifically the end of semester critiques, which were this strangely ritualized thing where everyone in all the schools, which didn't go for all the other schools, only like, so everyone in sculpture, everyone in photography, and everyone in painting would all go to the painting crits. This did not apply in reverse. Like, for some reason, the painting crits were considered like great theater. So they would all come and they would watch, and you would set up your work, but no one was allowed to talk except for the artist and the teachers, but everybody was watching. And so, and this was sort of the end of the year entertainment. So you'd put up your work and then you'd sit, and they were scheduled, and it was all like this sort of intense, like it was like the science fair, you know, like, and, you know, people there include like Pierre Halley is there now, Mel Bochner used to be there, or he's probably still there. But like, you know, some big names, and then other people who are just like, they've just been at Yale forever. And Yale has this sort of very heavy, when people think about like the art machine and they think of art grad schools, Yale is like at the top of the list of like machine grad schools. So like, this is the ritual that we went through. And
wasn't Jones the chair around that time, or was he already gone by then?
He was probably then. He was Ronald Jones. He was gone by the time I got there.
Okay.
But yeah, it was about to be Peter Halley when right after I left. But it was very, for a lot of people, it was very intense. And for a lot of people, the teachers, it was like their moment to sort of tear apart the students that they didn't like. And for the teachers who did like you, they had already been helping you all semester and being nice to you. The teachers who didn't like you, you hadn't been signing up to see them. And so they were like, this is my chance to make sure that you suffer. And, you know.
And it's funny also to think about that those teachers have already seen a generation or two of students go on and become successful artists. And even knowing that some of these students that they have probably will as well.
Yeah, I think that is part of the engine of it, is that like the people who were just out of school, they weren't mean.
Like, just like hazing.
It was the ones who had been there a long time and had gone on to see their least favorite student become famous. They were like, I'm not letting that happen again. You know, like, I'm going to.
So it sounds like
I'm going to wage psychological war and make sure that never happens.
And the degree to which that worked amazed me. You know, like, some people really did.
People are young. They don't know that it doesn't mean anything.
It sounds like basically a bitterness train of these older professors.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it was always a circus. Like, it was, I mean, there, like anyone who's been to art school, like, a critique is a critique. But you also know that there's, like, extremes. And the extremes could be very extreme. Like, there was somebody who, like, went to their crit and they just all, they painted all paintings of Mel Bochner being raped by animals. Because, like, that is how intense things had gotten for them. And there was another kid who was, like, he was drinking water the whole time, but it turned out to be vodka. And he'd just been drinking vodka his whole crit. And there's lots of people who cried.
And how does that – let's get play that out a little bit. I mean, is this kind of a tearing and talking kind of thing? Or is it more, you know, they just kind of shut down, or they cry when people are starting to leave? Or
there's no typology. 80% of the time it's just a boring crit. But 20% of the time, with 20 people, two semesters every year, like, it's actually surprising, you know, like, there's fireworks every year, you know, to the point where we actually decided one year to, like, do a pool reward for the worst crit as a way to sort of counter program. Like, no matter what they do to you, you're going to get $200. So, like, whoever has the worst time gets $200. So we all put in $5 or whatever, and then the person who we voted for the worst crit, and they got the money. And so it was, like, sort of a compensation for having been pecking partied, you know. But it wasn't always terrible. A lot of times it was just a critique, or it was just dull. But the potential – the extremes were surprising enough. Like, the degree to which – the teachers didn't talk to each other to one person would say something and someone would say the opposite. And it was like, you didn't get the feeling they wanted to teach sometimes. Like, you didn't get the feeling these two people who disagreed violently needed to, like, talk to each other in the Athenaeum tradition and come to a description of the world that fit both of their observations that would help this other person meet ambitions which they could both admit had nothing to do with anything they ever wanted themselves. Like, to put their ego aside. It was more like, you are this kind of artist and I am this kind of artist and I am just going to tell you everything that I hate about that kind of artist as quickly as possible so that it will be in you and you will doubt yourself. And then for some people, this really worked.
How did it work?
Well, what I felt like I observed was that artists who had come from LA or New York from college survived okay usually. They kind of like took it in stride. The ones who were not from there often had been the best artists in their college, like Arkansas, and they were like, you're going to go to grad school, you're a great artist. And when they got to grad school at Yale, it was their first inkling that they were going to be part of the real art world. That was like being let in. And so they took everything that happened very seriously. And so all those people who hadn't already kind of been close to the bullshit of the art world in undergrad took it real seriously, and they either adopted a lot of attitude about the art world and art in general, because just as a defense to deal with it, or they just believed everything the teachers told them. Like, just were like, oh, really? Just like mouth open, drooling, just, oh, okay, I'll do that, use more blue. Like, those were the two forms of Yale damage. Like, just total acceptance, like, teachers told me this, so I did it. Or total, like, contrarianism, like a not helpful contrarianism where it's like, I'm not going to paint anything in Fridays, you know, fuck Fridays. And just something stupid that's ultimately self-defeating. They just took it too seriously. Whereas the people who had kind of been close to, like most of my friends who had been to Cooper with me were like, yeah, it's just more bullshit. You know, they're like, you take what's good, you know. But for a lot of people, going to Yale was such a disruptive difference from what they were used to in life. And from the idea of teaching, that they were just fucked up. I mean,
well,
I think...
Well, and then yeah. The way that you conclude your piece in Artillery is that you actually think that that damage and that trauma cascades out into the rest of art discourse, and that it actually has a chilling effect. You think that artists maybe don't express themselves as much because of that early crit trauma.
Right.
Do you think that's true?
No, yeah. I mean, and thanks for bringing that up, because that like keeps me from hitting the same point over and over. That's true. Is like most artists see talking as an opportunity to get in trouble, not as an opportunity to do anything good with the work. Like you see, and that is why, like Mel Bochner himself said, you know, Warhol did this, and this is what you do. You put on a mask. The artist must be an enigmatic force. And I think that sounds good in the beginning, but then when you see how powerful critics are in terms of like magazines and interpretation, in terms of like they, you know, curators, and like when you see the degree to which their interpretation of things becomes the dominant interpretation, you can see, and then you look at the art world as a whole and how the interpretation of everything is, you think like 40, 50, 60 years of artists, best case scenario is wearing an enigmatic mask. We have these interpretations of art which are just on Mars, you know, because they've been so out of touch with what the artists are actually thinking or doing. And it's not like the artist has to control the conversation, but at a certain point it's like it seems so ungrounded because artists are so scared of saying, like, actually the way we got to this place that you all enjoy and respect and like was not at all through thinking about this and this and this. It has nothing to do with Hal Foster, you know, and it was like actually this. And I think that the reason we have, I think, I've never met anyone in the art world who would not agree that basically we have a pretty fucked up art conversation. Like, I've never met anyone who goes, I think the conversation about how art works is in a really healthy place right now. Like, I've never heard anyone say that. They'll say, like, they don't mind or it doesn't bother them, it's getting in their way, but they don't go, I love reading this stuff, it all makes perfect sense, and I feel like the engines of the art world are really straightforward.
Never hear anyone say the press releases are real.
No, yeah. And that's a good example. Like, the press release, you say to an artist, like, you want to do your own press release, and they go, that's just an opportunity to get into trouble. Like, talking is an opportunity for them to screw me, to nail me to the wall for saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing. I'm afraid to sound stupid. And so artists get to this point where, unless they're naturally people who like to – I mean, both of my parents were writers, so, like – I'm relatively comfortable talking, and I write for a living, in like not for a living, but like I get paid to write.
You write regularly.
For most artists, I think, and a lot of artists also, like, we have very international art world, so we have people from, like, Belgium who are in America showing and vice versa. So, but they see writing as an opportunity to get into trouble, and they see if somebody likes their art for some reason that has, like, review and they just don't understand anything in it. Like, they're like, I wasn't thinking about that at all. They don't say anything. They're like, good, you like it. Like, that's great. You know, like, I'm showing. Like, I'm not going to say it. I don't want to mess with the, look at the, you know, mess with the gift horse's mouth, you know? So I think that because of that, we have a conversation that's not a lot about what artists say. I think if you compare that to literature world, where a lot of times the general conversation in literature in any decade is kind of close to what people are actually writing about. And one of the reasons I think that is because novelists, if they write about – or if a novelist writes a review, it gets as much or more respect than if a full-time critic writes a review. Like when John Updike says something about a novel, people pay attention. He's a novelist. And so I don't think it all has to be like that. Like there shouldn't be any critics. But I think that the fact that writers are – you know, they are articulating in the form where they matter,
right,
makes that critical dialogue a little bit closer to home. Like everything, yeah, all of David Foster Wallace's nonfiction is in the conversation about fiction. Like it's inside the conversation about how we interpret the Jonathans. Like it's in the conversation about how we interpret postmodernism, because he's as respected as any critic. And I think that if you look at forms where critics have almost no say, like in music, other than as gatekeepers, like their interpretation of music is like no one cares. Like you're just like, you're in the magazine or you're out. But other than that, like no one really gives a shit. You can see a totally different conversation going on. And then if you look at one where it's kind of balanced, like film, which is like about half popular interpretation and about half film buff interpretation, it's like film almost seems like a very healthy conversation. Like if you're into horror movies, you can get online and see a whole spectrum of interpretation of a horror movie. There's none of this like one note thing. There's no dominant, like it has to be this or it has to be that. There's no fake teleologies where each horror movie necessarily grew out of the last horror movie. Like, and then you can do that for any genre. Like if you're into like, I don't know, like if you're into screwball romance, like you can, like there's a body of literature that's well written about screwball romance. And it's like, part of that comes from the popular opinion and the opinion of the directors being as important as the people who write critically. Whereas in art world, we're all trying not to talk because we don't want to trip over our own shoes, because we're all just happy to be here, happy to be employed in this economy, happy to have a show, don't want to fuck it up, you know, and you write this press release because people will ignore it. Like you're saying, I'm undermining normative assumptions right, about, right. Great. Fine, whatever. But you're coming and you're buying it. Great. I don't want to mess with that program.
Well, you are writing about things yourself, so you are entering into that dialogue that you're talking about. What generally would you say your intention is? Do you like to sort of carve your own path, or is it inevitable that you're going to be responding to a larger dialogue this way?
I feel like a little teeny tiny turning point came for me where I was talking to Sean Landers and I was explaining something. He was like, well, that's you. You're self-explanatory. And he was like, that's right. Like, that is like, it is in my nature to just explain shit. Like, it has less to do with any goal in explaining shit. It's simply like, in order to be me, like, not explaining shit all the time would just be trying to pretend to be someone else. And so, part, like, that's that. Like, it's almost more of a tick than it is a goal-oriented thing. On the other hand, I can, like I just did, lay out, like, reasons why it's a good goal. Like, I think, actually, the art dialogue is healthier when artists are talking. But for me, it's a tick. Like, it's just, to me, the numinous and the beautiful and the mysterious stuff is stuff that you're never going to fuck up by talking about it. You know, I think that maybe someone like Andy Warhol was scared that if he explained too much about one of these pictures, they would lose their mystery. And maybe their mystery was fragile. Whereas to me, like, Bernini could sit down and talk all day about how he made the Ecstasy of St. Teresa, and it would never stop being mysterious and beautiful.
Yeah,
you know?
I'd agree with that.
And so for me, like, the stuff that puts it beyond words is never going anywhere. So I don't mind explaining and talking you know.
What was the context that you were talking with Sean Landers?
Sean taught at Yale for a while, and so
was he involved in any of those crits?
He was, and he hated them. Like, he was definitely one of those people who was an outsider. Like, I think he came for the first time in my first year, like, visiting. He was like, those things are fucked up. A lot of people from the outside were like, those things are fucked up. Like, I don't think it helps people.
Yeah.
Sean was very much like a counter-programmer. Like, he was always trying to be like, hey, loosen up, dudes. You know, like, it'll be, you know. And I think he was – most people there who took his class seemed to think that he was a useful teacher because he was taking an outside thing and he wasn't really – aggressively critical about anybody's practice, but is still trying to, at the same time, trying to push people to do something different. Like, his thing was a lot of, like, messing around, you know, sort of put in a creative space. Like, he would say, he asked everybody questions about their first experience with art, and then gave everyone little assignments based on their first experience with art, which is very not grad school. Grad school is do whatever you want, and I tell you what I think, you know. So he was like, I told him, like, something about making crayon drawings of airplanes or something. He was like, oh, you talked about your mom. Here, your assignment is to make a portrait of your mother in any media, you know? So, like, he was like that. He was, like, the playful Robin Williams guy, you know? Or he tried to
just
be.
Just like some of his work.
Yeah, like, and he, rather than, he didn't feel like he was the guy who had the ultimate responsibility for sending us out into the world as artists. He was more like, what's going on in this crazy place? All right, let's mix things up. At least at the time.
Well, sadly, then, the people who were having these fucked up crits were the ones who were thinking they were going to send you out into the world better artists, right?
No, yeah. I mean, those are the people who were, like, on the – and also, it may not have been down to any one of them. It may have just been the critical mass of all of them together and them having a poor group dynamic with each other. You know, like, if Sam thinks this and Lisa thinks that and Sam and Lisa can't talk to each other, but they all have to – they have a half an hour to make your $72,000 investment worthwhile, like – maybe that was part of it. Like, I don't want to put it all on any one person. There were people that I didn't get along with, but I think that the structure as a whole just didn't work. But it also represented a lot of things about art school and why people are afraid to talk. Because it's not only Yalies who are afraid to talk, it's everybody. Like you were saying on this podcast, it's hard to get artists to talk. Like, a lot of them are not good talkers. And I think that is dangerous in the long run if all of them are scared, you know, especially considering, like, how many of them, like, are into film, they're into writing, like, they, you know, words should be something that are near what they do, even if it's not only what they do.
Sure.
But yeah, people are scared as shit.
When I had a conversation with a few of the students who were in Michael Asher's crit class at CalArts that was profiled in Sarah Thornton's book. And one of the things that I asked them about is, to what extent did you know what you were getting into, you know, with these marathon crits? And so, talking about Yale, I wonder, A, to what extent did your fellow students know what they were getting into? I kind of presume it was just like, this is Yale. That's why you go there. And then, to what extent do you and your colleagues have a sense that this is the right step to take because of X, Y, and Z reason?
I think that you're kind of slowly prepared, you know, like, over time. Like, I think people expect to have crits, I guess. I mean, it was just, like, the level of, like, weirdness of the individual things that people said during them that was, like, I remember one teacher, this woman, Frances Barth, was like, well, the only thing I can tell from your work to this artist, Sean McCarthy, was, like, what I see when I look at Egon Schiele's work, which is I just see you're a sexual predator. And it was like, holy shit, you said that out in public to other humans. You know, and it was like, really? Like, that's that a person pays your salary to make them better at a trade they're trying to learn. And then you say that to them, like, is that going to help? Like, I think getting into the mindset of, like, you'll say one provocative thing to a person, it'll turn their head around, has ruined so many teachers. Like, you're not teaching at that point. You're just hitting someone with a stick and hoping that they'll, I don't know. Like, to me, teaching is like, it's like having a kid. It's a huge responsibility. It's like someone's investing so much of their future, you're mortgaging your future in the hopes that this will actually make you better at something that you're going to try to spend the rest of your life doing. And then just be like, well, here's the thing. I look at what you made and fuck you. Like, really, like, just go fuck yourself. And then it's like, well, maybe I told you to go fuck yourself 2 years ago and now you're happy. It made you a better person. Like, no. Like, that's not, like, you know, in math class, they don't teach like that. You know, in PE, they don't teach like that. But for some reason in the art world, it's like, okay to do that. Because it's like, you know, well, if you were a genius, you'd respond properly. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Well, you know, the biggest problem to me, or one of the biggest anyway, is the context that this woman, you know, and the other tenured professors are doing this. It's a performance, you know? I mean, if you really want to impart some wisdom or some insight, do it in their studio. Why, you know, if you're doing, it's just for your own self-aggrandizement if you're doing it in a pit.
I mean, I'm not against, like, public crits with other, as long as other students can talk. Like, I think that actually a lot of the most interesting things were said to me by other students because people don't necessarily, they're not necessarily super articulate all the time, but you can be like, this kind of person reacts this way, and you can get information out of that. I just think that that requires a level of discipline that maybe after 40 years of teaching kind of drifts away. You know, like it requires a level of like, and I think that people who visited knew it. The people who were just visiting like Yale once or twice would be like, or any other school, they'd be like, oh, let's do a thing. But then you get used to it. You get calm and you're like, oh, another crit, another day. And you're just, there's an opportunity to say what you want. Rather than like, I need to, you stop trying to prove that to yourself that you're trying to help people and you start just trying to get out whatever you're worried about that day or angry about that day.
Why did you decide to go get the MFA?
I didn't dance or sell drugs, so I needed a way to hang out around other artists until I got famous. And that's what you have to do. You hang around other artists until somebody with more power than you goes, I like you, and now you're a real artist.
Larry Clark couldn't discover you in a park somewhere?
He almost did. The kid who just died,
yeah.
From Kids, he hung out at Cooper. Like, he was shooting, like, Kids was right around the time I was in college.
Which, for people listening, because I'm not aware of this either, which was the kid in Kids that recently died?
I forget
his name. One of the main characters?
Yeah.
Casper died a while ago. Mm. Kid who plays Casper, right?
It was the black kid. I forget his fucking name.
Mm.
He had a super distinctive face, but he used to hang out at Cooper right around that time. And, you know, like, it could easily, like, I was just skateboarding past that park and not get, you know, but I mean, it was like that exact time, you know.
But you felt like, actually, you assessed it sort of as a young person with needing prospects going forward. You thought that the MFA was a good choice. Like, you would be someplace instead of
literally,
sort of
literally what I did was the only older artist who I had a good rapport with was the guy, the tech in the photo department. His name was Danny. He's a great artist. Danny Goodwin.
Danny Goodwin.
Yeah. So Danny Goodwin was my boss, basically. So I was checking out photo equipment and Danny Goodwin was there. And one day I was working with Danny and I said, should I go to grad school? And he was like, yeah, every teacher here went to grad school. Every artist, like, go. And he's like, you know, you get to just do nothing for 2 more years. And I was like, okay. So basically because of Danny. But under that, it was also like I did get that you had to be a sociable person to be an artist. You had to be around other artists. And I was not like organically – I wasn't good at that. Like I wasn't like
– right.
Like I lived at that time like on the east side next to a bunch of squatters and I just hung out with them. You know, like on C Squat – or not C Squat, the one on 5th and B. And like – that they weren't going to give me a show. You know, like those are my – you know,
they're
or
not
like
– a very good one.
But I mean, you know, ABC Rio is actually kind of a great space, but long story. but the point was, like, I was not mixing with, like, gallery people. Like, that wasn't my crew. And so I realized that, like, and it's like, even as an undergrad, like, that's kind of how the art world works. And it's like, and he was like, yeah, if you're not, like, naturally just, your parents weren't rich or, like, you're not a bartender or something, you've got to, like, find a way to be around the art world, and like grad school is a way to kind of pay to be around the art world for a couple more years. And he was like, yeah, get a loan, you'll pay it off, you know, somehow. And everyone else did it, and it, you know, they're fine. And I was like, okay, because I couldn't see any other thing. Like, it didn't occur to me. I think that now so many things occur to me, you know, like go be a steamboat captain and then come back, and, you know, but at the time I was just like, I was remarkably straightforward from high school. I was like, I want to be an artist. How do you do that? What's the next step?
Right.
Draw, then go to art school, then do that, you know? And so I was like, okay, I'll do this. And it worked for me because I was like the kind of person who was able to talk to teachers in a language they could understand because I had been, had books around me when I was a kid, you know, and even though I was like in a crappy little single parent home, I had always been like a big reader and I had always read art books even when I was like tiny. And so I was able to talk to teachers and teachers were able to grasp that I was good at that. As a lot of people are really smart or they're good artists, but they don't have anything in common with their teachers and they can't talk. And so they don't develop any, you know, so they're really good, but they academically doesn't reflect that. And I had just gotten to a groove where they were like, oh yeah, you're the smart one. And so things were kind of working. And so, yeah, that's why.
And Yale was just one of the most obvious choices.
Actually, I applied a bunch of places, didn't get in 1 year, spent a whole year not doing school, and then I applied again. And then I got in. And I got in because I had, in the interim, met some Yale students who then vouched for me. Like, they don't like to let in people right out of college. And right. So they were like, oh, that guy's cool. And then it was including, like, Becky from Bellwether Gallery. I had met her in the interim. But it was like, I mean, in the end, it's kind of sickening. It's like all just like talking to people and luck and networking, and it's like it shouldn't be like that. It should have just been like, you know, I don't know what it should be like, but it was.
Yeah, yeah. David Robbins, who is featured in this book by Roger White, who I just spoke to on the podcast, had this great line about being in Milwaukee, you know, an alternate art center. And he said, basically, you know, I've got 80% of the art world here. And Roger basically said, the other 20% is who you're sitting next to at a dinner party.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's just remarkably, it's like that.
Yeah.
And it will, it's funny to me, like, very little news in the universe is about the art world. You know, you don't go, like, what's the news today? It's about the art.
That's why, by the way, that I thought it was so cool that the, that pretty harsh review of The Broad was on the front page of the New York Times a couple weeks ago.
At least it was about art.
Yeah.
They do that thing on, they do it on purpose. They like that.
Well, I think the New York Times and art have a symbiotic relationship in a way that almost no other news organ does. Like, because that keeps New York, New York, you know, that they have art, you know. But it's funny to me how when any other business from like sports to movies to books is revealed to be like the art world in any way, it's a scandal. Whereas in the art world, we just accept all.
Right.
It's like, yeah, we're living the 16th century. That's what we do here. And they're, if that happened anywhere else, they'd be like, really? Like, you know, it's like, yeah, it's the way it is. You just signed up for this.
Did you, I heard you, one of your other classmates was Kehinde Wiley?
Yeah, Kehinde was in the same year as me.
How did he do in the crits?
Kehinde was despised by the teachers. He was not liked at all, and Kehinde did not like to, he did not have a good rapport with the teachers as far as I could tell. And he and a lot of other really good artists got to the Harlem Studio School afterwards, which is like a factory for young black artists, like becoming successful. It was a really good place. I think Will Villalonga went there, who I was a Cooper with, and I think Wangeshi went there, Wangeshi Mutu. I don't know. Did Mickey and Iona go there? Mickey Thomas, Iona.
Probably.
Yeah. But like those people were Yale too. But but yeah, that place, if you got in, well, the thing was like at Yale there were like 20 students. There were very few black students each year, but at the Harlem Studio School, of course, everybody's black. And then everybody who went there like at that during that period just like had a career afterwards. And so, yeah, I think that's what happened to Kehinde. He just like at Yale, he was just like, they're just like, what are you doing? He was like, I don't know. And, you know, and they didn't get along, you know. But yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And then, okay, so you graduate, get out of there. Now you have to sort of spread your wings. But you said that when we were talking earlier that your work had started to get some notice while you were still in graduate school, and so you started showing pretty much
Like, I wasn't showing while I was in grad school, but pretty much right out of grad school, I got put in a group show at Fredrickson Friser, and I still show there today.
Yeah.
So that group show led to more stuff.
I mean, that's in and of itself is really interesting. So how many – you've had how many shows there? 7 or 8 shows?
I mean, every year or two, I have a show at Friser. The thing about Friser, and this is probably good for, you know, if you're coming up, is I think most young artists who have some success in the beginning end up in 1 or 2 situations. Either A, they get to a really good gallery, but because they're new, they're the least important artist at that really good gallery, which means they don't pay any attention to you. And so stuff that you might actually need, like they're like, what? You? Who are you? Or they are the breakout successful artist at their friend's like little teeny tiny scrappy gallery. And so that gallery paying the rent depends entirely on you and your prices, and there's tremendous pressure on you. Everything about your work is kind of micromanaged by the gallery because they need to pay their rent based only on how you sell. And I was in neither of those situations. I got to Friser, and John Wesley and a few other big artists like pay the bills at Friser, but they weren't like John Wesley's reputation was made years ago. He doesn't need attention. Dude just makes a painting once in a while. Like, he doesn't. And so they were paying a lot of attention to me while they weren't relying on me to pay the bills, which is kind of a perfect situation. So we actually have a really good relationship and pretty much have ever since. You know, I mean, I've showed other places, but we get along.
They obviously loved your work from the beginning.
Yeah.
Treat you that way, right?
Yeah. I mean, we got along and I like them. And I mean, I think that their whole thing at the time was kind of like, and still is like, they're kind of into pop art, kind of into sexual stuff, but they're also kind of like very into like cutting edgy kind of stuff. And so it was kind of like right in the crosshairs of what they were doing. Mm-hmm. We got along. You know, I haven't got a bad word to say about Fred and Jess and Andy. They've kind of been like one of the few like things, reliable things in the art world to me that were legible. Like, I knew, you know, talk to them and they sound like regular people, you know.
That stability is actually really important. I think artists don't always realize that. But actually having a sort of stable gallery relationship, if you're fortunate enough to have it, actually allows you to kind of concentrate on your work and, you know, just kind of keep doing it. Where you've seen people, or I've seen people over the years who have, you know, bounced around, and sometimes their work and mental health suffers because of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just think that anything but the work is doing less work. I mean, that's pretty simple. I mean, I think a lot of people, everybody has a different route because there's no recruiting. It's not like being a lawyer where you finish and people go, okay, here are the new lawyers, which would be great. Here are the new artists. there's a lot of people whose route is writing grants all the time. You know, they write grants, they write proposals. And there's a lot of people whose route is like, they get out and they just do street art until they get noticed. Or, you know, like people do different things, you know. So, but I think, and some people are able to incorporate whatever that is into their process. Like Molly Crabapple, like she fights for it, you know, but she's also like, that's part of what she does. Like being a little like writing an article and then illustrating it and then doing a show and then like doing a Kickstarter to have her own show. Like that's like her way of being an artist and works for her, you know. But I think for a lot, like I do stuff that's so labor intensive that if I was like out there hustling every day to get a new gallery, I think, you know, if everything was all on me like that, I would not get anything done. You know, like I need to be able to sit at the table and spend hours and hours doing like a square inch.
So meanwhile, you get this gallery that you have this long relationship with. And now about 8 years ago, and you were living in New York. Were you living in Brooklyn?
I wasn't all over, but yeah, mostly Brooklyn.
So about 8 years ago, you moved here to L.A., and you're now here downtown in L.A., which is like the closest thing to Manhattan that we have here. So why did you leave?
I was at a party in New York, and it was for this singer-songwriter, Jeff Lightning Lewis.
Oh, yeah, I know him.
Okay, you know Jeff. Okay.
Brooklyn, what is it? It's kind of a funny ripoff of a Bob Dylan song, but where he comes from Brooklyn and... gets raped on the train. Do you know that?
Oh, yeah, the Will Oldham. I saw Will Oldham. Yeah. It's a song about meeting Will Oldham on the train, and then he asks Will Oldham, like, what's it all about? Why? What are artists? What are we supposed to do? And then Will Oldham, like, throws him on the ground and beats the shit out of him, and he's like, where's your fucking pussies? And, like, then it's a good
YouTube
song.
It's pretty good. Jeffrey Lewis.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's not a very assuming name for a singer-songwriter, but he's great. I love Jeff. But anyway, it was at Jeff's birthday party, and much like Dylan himself, Jeff is surrounded by other singer-songwriters who are not Jeff. So I was in the kitchen, and I knew a bunch of dudes, and I was cutting bread, and this kid picked up an acoustic guitar at Jeff's birthday party and started singing the song. And the refrain to the song was, I wet my pants, I wet my pants. And so I came home, and I said, Mandy, let's move. We left New York after that.
That was the final straw.
I was like, the people we know here, they're like singer-songwriters and artists, and the people we know in L.A. are all porn stars and strippers. Let's move to L.A. So we moved.
Change of venue.
Yeah. And Mandy was like, oh, that's cool. Like, she had just come to – she had been in Bushwick before – pre-hipster Bushwick. So, like, ghetto Bushwick. For a year. Like, she would come from Canada to that and was living with me and was like, yeah, let's get out of here. So we moved to Hollywood and were there for a long time and eventually moved downtown.
And you said your dad lived out here or?
My dad lived out in L.A. when I was a kid. He was like a...
But he's not out here anymore.
He's in Ojai, actually. He moved up to like a surfer town like between here and San Francisco.
It's become a very hipster little getaway.
Really?
Apparently. Well, there was a New York Times piece this summer.
Really?
About it.
Yeah. You go visit again.
Yeah, you gotta go visit.
Visit your dad.
So you got your dad out here, and where is your mom?
My mom is in D.C. She hasn't talked to me since I started doing porn, so that was ages ago. So I have no idea.
Maybe, could we talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, my mom could be anywhere right now. I have no idea. She could be living in
New York. How did that shake down?
It was super simple. I was like, they're both going to Google me and find out. And so I was just like, I wrote him a letter saying like, hey, you know, like you guys are from the 60s. Like, this is just a thing that is happening. If you have questions, ask. And that was the end. Like, I never heard from her again after that.
But you heard from your dad?
Yeah. My dad was like, you know.
So he was hip to it and she wasn't?
Yeah.
Why do you think you haven't heard from her?
She's kind of a... I mean, she's my mom and it's porn. I mean, like, I think 80% of America would be like, oh. You know, like, yeah. She's like a regular person. Yep. You know.
Is she particularly religious or conservative?
I mean, she's conservative in the way that, like, a lot of liberals are conservative. In the way that, like, they're sort of sheltered. You know, like, she hasn't, you know, and so she's like a, a suburbanite or a wannabe suburbanite her whole life. You know, so she had, like, come from the farm and, you know, like, tried to get, like, a white-collar job and then, like, had raised a kid and out in the suburbs and tried to stay away from DC and all that and, like, you know, tried to, you know, and so it was kind of, like, not, you know, just not in her.
But they must be proud of the art part.
You'd think. I mean, they were both also, like, 60s people, so they're like, oh, trippy. You know, my dad, you know, they were both very proud of the art stuff, you know, and they're like, why is this not enough? And I'm like, you've never been to an art party, I guess. You know, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't tell you in detail. I haven't talked to her in years. But I feel like she's basically a normal mom to some degree on top of being, like, a 60s person and someone who wanted to be, like, a journalist. And, like, at a certain point, moms are moms. You know?
Do you mean, like, when you say a 60s person, do you mean, like, somebody who's from the counterculture? Against Nixon? Like
yes, exactly. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, Simon Garfunkel?
Definitely. Yeah, both of them. My dad wanted to be a fiction writer and write about, like, dragons and was a Chinese studies major. And my mom wanted to be, like, a muckraking journalist. And they were totally 60s people, you know, like, and they were hippies. And then, you know, they got divorced and then, like, became, like, 80s survival people, you know. So my dad was moved to Hollywood and started writing screenplays, and my mom started writing about, like, she went from writing about, like, muckraking journalism to, like, writing about solar power during Carter administration to just writing about houses to just writing about like roads for the government. But it was just like a, you know, like, smooth.
And
like,
this brings us to Pynchon, because those are like all his themes.
But wait a second.
I'm jumping ahead a little bit. You have to admit, like, that's like the paranoia, solar energy, you know.
Journalism. I definitely think that, like, counterculture. I mean, my dad was also like, he wanted to be a fiction writer, so he was like a link. He was the one who gave me Borges and stuff. So like that thing of like Pynchon's whole thing of like his vision is very historical. How did this system result in that system? So like how did 1918 result in 1945? How did 1945 turn into 1967? And then in Vineland, it's like, how did 1967 turn into 1980, whatever. And like, so those themes are very much like something that resonated with me. Cause I also think in like system
formed you and how you were able to then adapt those things from actually probably pretty deep place. Like you understood probably things in that book that can turn into those.
Well, but wait a second. We're getting away from his mom, which is where this all originated.
Yeah,
so
that's right. Sorry, mom.
Yeah. So what I want to know is, were you basically fuck her kind of, or I mean, I imagine you were pretty hurt at some point.
I mean, we had always had a rocky relationship. She was a single mom, and I was her only kid, really. And I was not a person who should have parents. I think is basically. Like, if you look at, like, normal things parents do, those are all things that I don't need or don't want done. And so, like, me and having parents was a bad fit to begin with, you know? And
tough teenage years?
I mean, it wasn't even that tough as much as it was just, like, are you trying to do this? Like, you know, like, it just didn't work, you know? Like, it just, like, she had enough of her own stuff to go through. Like just being a, you know, like a single woman in DC trying to make ends meet. And I had my own stuff and I was like a fully formed person getting my own shit done. And then she would be like, try to parent once in a while. I'd be like, really? Clean my room. I got shit. I got a novel to write.
Like, right.
You know, like it was just, you know, and it was just like, I don't think she was especially bad person as much as like, I shouldn't have parents and I had one. And so we just didn't get along on that level. And then, you know, so by the time she was like, stopped talking to me, it was like, well, it almost made sense. It was just like, we're not.
Well, as far as the porn, I just, because, you know, we obviously have done a good job of not, you know, focusing on that. But I just want to ask you, what are maybe the top three or five things that you get, either that you can frame it however you want, that you get asked or that people assume but are wrong about?
Okay. I mean, I'm just going to say things that came to my mind. I
sure,
guess,
sure, go ahead.
I don't want to sit here being quiet on your podcast. But, like, a lot of people don't understand the, like, the breadth or variety of people who are involved in porn. Like, they think of it as one world, even though it's a relatively tight-knit community. Like, I would say, like, there's more of a porn community than anything else I've ever been involved with that was a community. Like, people would be like, you were in a band, you was a part of the New York hardcore scene. And I was like, kinda. Like, we knew some other bands, but didn't feel like, you know, I could call up Agnostic Front if I had to. And then the same thing in the art world. Like, I feel like I know other artists and then I know our 3 degrees of separation, but I don't feel like, you know, like, me and Jerry Salts are going to have dinner, you know? Whereas the porn world feels like a community. Like, you're in or you're out, or like, oh, Dana. Everybody knows Dana. Everybody has a Dana story. You know, like, it feels like a community.
So across from the really alternative to the really mainstream?
Oh, yeah, because there's no alternative anymore. All the people who, when I came up, and the people I've written about in We Did Porn, who were, like, the tattooed people on the – like, those people are now hosting the AVN Awards. Like, James Dean and Tommy Pistol are, like, they're the center of the industry now, like those guys. So there's no.
I don't know who either of those guys are.
But those are the dudes. Like, if you were a porn person and listened to this podcast, you'd be like,
oh come on, Michael. James Dean. You know them.
Aaron?
but I mean, like, Bonnie Rotten won Performer of the Year last year, and she's, like, got more tattoos than anyone I've seen. She has spider webs on her boobs. Like, it's like, this is Performer of the Year, and she just looks like. In 2002, that was, like, the people who were like, this is the alternative porn. Like,
right.
It was clearly just, you know.
Right.
But anyway, my point was, like, people assume that, like, everybody in porn's like a drug addict from like a like a whorehouse. And it's like, no, there's just like a variety of people like there is kind of in the art world. It's like some of them are like film students, and some of them are like kids who just like, they are like art school kids essentially who did camming and then they did stripping and then they're like, oh, you can make a lot of money doing this. And then some of them are like, you know, fucked up junkies. And then some of them are like, but just like the spread of people who are involved is like almost any other enterprise that doesn't have like a sort of education gate where everyone has to have the same, like not everyone has an MFA or not, but you know, it's a variety of people. Mm. So that's probably the number one thing. It's like, there's not a sort of homogeneity there that you'd expect. Mm. And when people do violate, it's weirdly nice in the sense that like when there is pathological behavior or something fucked up, people notice and care and get pissed off at each other. Like, it's a small enough community that if somebody is being an asshole, it gets around and people don't want that to happen. It doesn't like normalize shitty behavior. It's weird. Things that I get asked. I mean, like, a lot also just about girls, because people don't understand women and sex. Like, there's a lot of women who do porn who really like it. Like, they like a lot of, oh, here's a thing. It's like, a lot of women in porn are people who are like very, very sexual, but also super shy and introverted. And so they don't know, like, they don't know how to like talk to people in bars. Like, they don't know how to like meet people. And so like doing porn was like a way for them to like get laid a lot without having to deal with how awkward they were. Wow. Without having to vet people to see if they were cool. Like, a lot of it.
That's true.
Thank you, Mandy.
That was Mandy, everybody.
Yeah.
Who's a porn star?
Yes.
Do you want to come on the mic, Mandy, for a moment?
Yeah.
No, I'm shy.
She said, no, I'm shy. That's perfect. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, people, like, a lot of the strangeness, I think, around women and sex is that women are always sort of trying to vet partner, like, heterosexual women. They're trying to vet men without just being like, pull down your pants and let me figure out what's going on down there. And so they're always taking men's behavior as a symbol of something else. And so, and in porn, they don't have to. You just press a button and you're like, oh, that's what that guy has sex like. And that's how dangerous he is. And that's how much he'll throw your head up against the wall. Like, a lot of things that are kind of vague on a date are clear on the, and so a lot of people actually really like that. And then the next biggest thing is like, for the people in the industry, the hardest, most difficult thing isn't like, anything in the industry, it's the stigma from people outside the industry toward them. Like, it's really hard for them to date people outside the industry because the girl or the guy will always start to get nervous, like, oh, you're fucking like 90 other people besides me, and after a year or two they always get like weird about it. Or you're trying to do like, try to talk to your doctor and like the doctor's like, I don't know if this is healthy, and you're like, go fuck yourself, like, this is my, you know. Or like, you know, we go to Canada, you know, we go across the border. Like, one time I had a friend who, Mandy's from Canada, so my friend was coming to visit us and was like, they're like, who are you going to stay with? And they're like, oh, like, this is the name, like, Zach Smith. And they Googled me, and they're like, oh, this guy? So then I got in fine, but they Googled me, found out I was in porn, and then, so they ran a background check on my friend, because he was coming, and he had, like, an old DUI, and they're like, you know, we can keep you out of Canada for this. And he's like, yeah, but you don't, like, have to, it's, like, pretty normal. And they're like, it's 8 years old, but we can. And they actually sent him home on the next plane just because. Like, the so that when you have to interact with, like, the legal system or the medical system, it's not so much what happens in porn that will fuck you up. It's the way people outside the system react to you being in porn that is fucked up.
Wow.
But, yeah, there was enough things that I wrote a book about it. So people.
That's your memoir. What's it called?
We Did Porn.
Got it.
But yeah, it has pictures if you can't read real well. So it's 100 pages of pictures and 200 pages of writing.
Was the book well received?
There's a lot of reviews. All the reviews were good. Kirkus and all those, but it was also sort of mostly read in literary circles. Like, it was a small press, Tin House Press, who puts out like Tin House Magazine. They're very arty. Like, so everyone who read it liked it. but it was, you know, was not a bestseller by any means. But it was, I felt like, I still feel good about it now, which is weird for something I wrote that long, like, you know, 5 years ago or whatever. So I feel like the things I need to say about the industry were said in that book.
You know. I feel like I heard about it when it came out. So it got publicity and stuff. Did any of your porn colleagues read it?
Yeah, actually, I was surprised that, like, a lot of people who have done, like, way more movies than me, like, way more involved in the industry, were like, this is dead on. You know, like, Stoya was like, this is good. Like, this is the book. And a lot of people who, girls who hadn't done porn by that point, but who have now, and, like, they read the book, and they were like, oh, I want to hang out with these people. Like, these, you know, like, it was, like, a lot of people, like, literature people and art people, but also, like, a lot of porn people were like, this is an accurate thing, you know, like. So that was cool because I felt like I was writing from a very specific, like, I don't know. I felt like I was just writing for me, you know, in a certain sense. And it was cool that, like, a variety of people were like, yeah, this.
So maybe a good way to bring things full circle is what generally kind of, and maybe I'm guessing that you probably don't hear things honestly, but what kind of perception do you feel like you get from the art world being in the porn world?
I don't know. It's really, I mean, it's super hard to tell. Like, because the thing that I get asked, like in colleges or something is like, did things change after you did porn? And it was like, when I did my first movie, I had just come out with my first coffee table book. I had just come off the Whitney Biennial, like by a year or 8 months or so, probably about a year. I was having a show literally at SF MoMA at the time of my first film. So I have no, like, there was so much noise that it was hard to tell how that was affecting my career, if at all.
Right.
You know, like,
right.
It was just sort of part of the mix for me.
And as far as on an interpersonal level, most people they already kind of know you a little anyway, or?
I guess, yeah. I
mean, kind of seems like that.
It's hard to tell. Like, it's super hard to tell, like, with those people. Like, to me, the art world is, like, one of the most opaque businesses in the world to begin with.
Right.
You know, and so that simply was another factor that made it opaque to me. I do get surprised by some questions. Like, some people are like, so you mostly make money in porn? I'm like, fuck no. Like, I'm a painter. It's my job. Like,
right.
I've made, like, 5-10 movies. You know, like, so, like, there's some people who think, like, there's some people who probably think that, like, I do, like, porn is my job. And some people who, like, thought that, like, I was a porn actor and then became a painter, which sounds like a more normal, like, what you would do. Like, escape the terrible blue-collar job and have the wonderful white collar job, which is not it either. But I really don't know. I mean, people have people in the art world are really tight lipped.
I would think
I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but
I would think that it wouldn't harm you at all, because there's always been a place for you know, the artist is a wild man or a beast who's deviant and lives outside of the bounds of normal society and so forth. And, you know, I'm sure it wouldn't hurt at all. It would be interesting, actually, and, you know, given the type of work that you make, which is sort of very graphic and detailed and sometimes dark and has dark subject matter. Like, could Agnes Martin do porn? And how would it
Let's
affect
not
her career?
Talking about dark.
That's quite a contrast.
I mean, I don't know, because I think also, like, part of I don't know whether people.
I think there's lots of artists that wish they could do porn.
Sure, and there's lots of.
Everybody has the.
There's lots of porn people who wish that they could just do art. Like, it's amazing how many of them are, like, painters and want to go to art school, or, like, you know, like, they just, like, oh, I wish I could draw, you know, like, or, like, oh, I used to draw, you know, like, grass is always greener.
Yeah.
But I don't know to what, like, because by definition, if someone's talking to me, I'm talking back. Like, the crazy guy, like, the pathological Van Gogh artist, like, I don't know, like, people who have come in contact with my writing, like, probably can't maintain that illusion. They're like, you know, they're probably, it's probably just super confusing, like, because I don't write, like,
the collectors don't read,
right? But nobody, but I mean, I write enough, and I'm like, I have a loud enough mouth that I'm like, probably that loudmouthness overpowers a lot. I don't know. I have no idea, you know, like, I really don't know. Like, I don't know what, like, like, I have no collectors who have met, who have, like, collected my work, and I have no idea what they're, like, 70, 80-year-old people are, like, oh, he does porn now, and, like, I don't know if they're just, like, that's weird, or they're, like, oh, like, Matthew Barney, like, I don't know what they think. And if I did know what they think, it would mean because I had talked to them. If they had talked to me, then probably their impression is from having talked to me rather than something else.
Right, and then, right.
So I would welcome anyone listening to the podcast to tell me, because I don't know. I don't know what the secondhand view looks like.
Well, to go back to, I believe, something that you and I talked about on the phone when we first connected, my sense was that, and this holds true often for me in this podcast, which is like, you write these things, you occasionally hear from one or two people, you know, it's not that big a deal, whatever they say.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think that maybe you don't know because there's not a critical mass. I know that art students love me. That I know for sure.
Because they love your work?
Yeah, basically.
They love your whole package?
I don't know. Sometimes, once in a while they're that forward. But
oh, I just some of them are. I didn't mean forward to do that. That was totally unintentional. No pun intended.
But no, I mean, art students write to me all the time, and they're like, "Love your work, love everything you do, like how like you're straightforward." But they're also people who are like very wired. So like, if they find you, they'll find an essay I've written 10 minutes later. They'll find my Tumblr. They'll find Ask FM. They'll find like all that stuff because they're kids,
right?
And so they're super good at that. And those people overlap with art collectors 0%. They are completely non-overlapping universes,
sure.
And so I don't know.
Well, Aaron, thank you for shotgunning.
You're welcome. Happy to do it.
And Zach, thank you very much for talking to us.
No problem. I thought we had a whole hours left to go. Because you kept saying, "Oh, we're not going to talk about that yet," and I was like, "Oh God, it's gonna."
I don't think we talked about anything that I said we're not going to talk about.
No, I just thought we were putting things off, and then we're like, this is okay.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Good. And
we're out.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much again to Zach for filling us with all kinds of information about his work, his other work, his porn work, and his observations about the art world. I you can hear how much he has spent time talking to people about the art world and how it works, and you know, his various insightful observations about it. I would be very curious to know, meanwhile, what you thought about his premise that there's no art podcast of record, and that as if there should be, and as if there will be. And then he also said that if there was one, we would all hate it. So what do you think about that? Where does the conversation fall in that? I feel like there was a little bit of polite language going on there, and I'm not really sure what he thinks, but maybe you can help me put two and two together. Thank you very much as well to Aaron Morse for co-hosting. I think he did a great job. He did a lot of behind-the-scenes work that you didn't hear, but I was glad to have him along with me. And he would have liked to have gotten into a much longer conversation about Zach did an illustration for an edition of Gravity's Rainbow, the Thomas Pynchon novel, and that's what they were starting to talk about, as you heard. But I wanted to talk about why Zach and his mother are strange. So those are our priorities. What are we going to do? Thank you very much again for being here. I would appreciate your feedback. I would certainly be happy if you wrote a nice review on iTunes so that more people can find this podcast, and so this podcast can become the art podcast of record. Thank you very much again for being here. I appreciate you listening, and I will talk to you soon.